producer Pat on today's bonus show. You can get access to the bonus show by signing up at joinpacman.com. Alex Jones doesn't want you to do this.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money. Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Yeah, Alex Jones, in fact, finds everything I do predatory.
That is a frickin' predator right
there. He doesn't like me. But I recommend signing up at joinpacman.com, and you can use the coupon code BIGVOTING22 to get a sizable discount. I will see you on the bonus show in a moment, or otherwise.
You're not to worry. But maybe that's a lie. Honey, what's your hurry? Won't you stay inside? Remember not to get too close to stars. They're never gonna give you love like ours. Where did you go? I should know, but it's cold and I don't wanna be lonely. So show me the way home. I can lose another life.
Full of flavor since 1949.
WRCT in sound from way out.
Ah. Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The problem here is that the NRA and the gun industry, the gun lobby in aggregate, have been putting out an extremist ideology based on fake history in order to convince their voters that A, they're on the right side of history, and B, gun control poses an existential threat to the freedom and safety and lives of their families and their futures.
As funerals continue in Uvalde, Texas, demand for gun control is mounting, with bipartisan talks underway on a red flag law that might be able to overcome a Republican-led filibuster in the Senate. Even as Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, and other Republicans address the National Rifle Association's annual convention in Houston to oppose new gun laws, we'll speak with Frank Smyth, a longtime investigative journalist, author of The NRA, The Unauthorized History. Then it was March 29th, 2018, when a U.S. drone strike hit the car Adel Al-Manthari and four cousins were driving in. He was the only survivor. We'll hear from Manthari about how the Pentagon refuses to admit it made a mistake and pay for his life-saving surgery.
It affected me greatly. My children are without their schools. My life is scattered. My children stay with me and cannot go out because of my disability. 4 years and I haven't moved.
Then we look at how civil rights groups are challenging a series of racist U.S. Supreme Court rulings that have been used for over a century to legally justify discrimination against people in Puerto Rico and other U.S. territories. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Funerals are continuing in Uvalde, Texas, for the 19 fourth graders and their two teachers shot dead at Robb Elementary School last week. The state's probe into the police handling of the school shooting is facing a major new obstacle as the police chief of the Uvalde School District, Pete Arredondo, is refusing to cooperate with state investigators. Arredondo was the incident commander who ordered officers to wait in the school's hallways for about an hour instead of confronting the gunman, who was eventually shot dead by a Border Patrol agent. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Arredondo was secretly sworn in as a city council member, but no public ceremony was held. This comes as ABC News has obtained audio of an emergency dispatcher alerting Uvalde police about the 911 calls being made by the children inside the school during the massacre. During an earlier police news conference, it was implied police did not know about the 911 calls from the students. In other news from Uvalde, the Texas Department of Public Safety has now revealed authorities mistakenly stated the gunman entered the school by a door that was propped open by a teacher. The state now says the teacher closed the door once it was known there was a shooter nearby, but that the door did not lock. We'll have more on the Texas shooting and the national debate on guns after headlines. The U.S. has announced it'll send an advanced artillery rocket system to Ukraine that can strike targets up to almost 50 miles away. The rocket system is part of a new $700 million U.S. military package for Ukraine that also includes Javelin short-range anti-tank rockets, artillery ammunition, helicopters, and air surveillance radar. The White House said Ukraine has given assurances it will not use the new rocket system to attack targets inside Russia. Russia blasted the U.S. arms package for Ukraine, saying the U.S. is, quote, deliberately pouring oil on the fire. The Wall Street Journal reports France and Germany are also expressing increasing concern over the shipment of more heavy weapons to Kyiv, over increasing skepticism that Ukraine can expel Russia from the Donbass region. Unlike the U.S. and U.K., France and Germany have been pushing for a negotiated ceasefire to end the war. This comes as Russia appears closer to seizing the city of Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine. On Tuesday, the governor of Luhansk said Russia has seized most of the industrial city, which has been devastated by weeks of shelling. Meanwhile, Russia is cutting off more gas supplies to Europe. On Tuesday, the state energy company Gazprom cut off some gas to the Netherlands, Denmark, and Germany. This came hours after the EU banned most Russian oil imports. The president of Senegal, Macky Sall, who chairs the African Union, has warned the European Union Africa is facing a food crisis with soaring wheat and fertilizer prices combined with increasing food shortages due to the war in Ukraine. During an address on Tuesday, Sall also criticized Western sanctions and Russia, saying it's making it harder for African nations to buy food. The African Development Bank says the price of wheat has already jumped 45% on the continent. Rania Dagash of UNICEF said the food crisis is coming as Africa is also confronting the climate crisis.
The fundamental issue in Somalia and in the Horn at the moment is a climate-induced crisis, right? It's drought. But where the effects of the Ukraine crisis come in is that the food prices and fuel prices and others are hiked up to a point where we need more resources to secure what we would have secured before. We need a lot more.
The United Nations is warning about a quote, exponential rise in civilian killings and abuses carried out by armed forces in Mali as it battles jihadist force fighters. A new UN report documents the deaths of 248 civilians by Malian defense and security forces in the first 3 months of the year. The UN also documented a tenfold rise in human rights abuses carried out by the state. The UN said the abuses were, quote, supported by foreign military elements, an apparent reference to the Wagner Group, a Russian paramilitary force. In news from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, at least 27 civilians were killed Saturday in attack by a rebel group, the Allied Democratic Forces. The Red Cross also reported 17 decapitated bodies were recently found in a neighboring province. The killings came in an area near the Ugandan border where Congolese and Ugandan forces are fighting rebel groups. Sri Lanka announced earlier today it's removing restrictions on imports in an attempt to ease the rampant shortages on food, fuel, and medicine caused by its dire economic crisis. This comes as Sri Lanka's government's begun applying for international aid while hospitals have begun to triage medical procedures due to a shortage in vital medical supplies and medications throughout Sri Lanka. In news from Washington, the Justice Department subpoenaed former Trump advisor Peter Navarro to appear before a grand jury. He's the first Trump official known to have been subpoenaed as part of the department's probe of the January 6th insurrection. The Missouri State Highway Patrol has launched an investigation after police officers in Kansas City shot a pregnant black woman named Leona Hale Friday. The shooting occurred after police stopped Hale and a man in a parking lot after a suspected carjacking. An eyewitness said police initially asked Hale to get on the ground, but she said she couldn't because she was pregnant. After police began approaching her with their guns drawn, she tried to run away. An eyewitness posted a video describing the aftermath of the shooting.
I stopped here to get some gas, y'all, and to get some ice cream for my kids, y'all. And my son just watched this. My 1-year-old son just watched this. My 10-year-old son just watched this. And my 13-year-old son just watched this happen. The man ran. She was finna cooperate. She got scared. She ran down there. They shot her. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Leona Hale was hospitalized with a broken arm and a collapsed lung. The Minneapolis City Council has agreed to pay a $600,000 settlement to a photojournalist who was blinded in one eye after being shot in the face by Minneapolis police in May 2020. Linda Tirado was shot while covering the mass protests in the city after the police killing of George Floyd. She permanently lost vision in her left eye. She also suffered a brain injury. A jury in Washington, D.C. has acquitted Michael Sussman, a lawyer for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, who was accused of lying to the FBI during its Trump-Russia probe. It was the first case brought to trial by special counsel John Durham, who has spent 3 years investigating the origin of the FBI's probe of Russian interference in the 2016 election. In Mexico, at least 11 people have died and 20 are missing after Hurricane Agatha triggered flooding and mudslides in the state of Oaxaca. Agatha was the strongest hurricane to ever hit Mexico during the month of May. In other environmental news, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has announced a new Office of Environmental Justice to address climate-related health problems affecting poor Americans and communities of color. And today, the World Health Organization is marking World No Tobacco Day. The WHO has just published a new report looking at the tobacco industry's devastating environmental impact. This is Rüdiger Kreck of WHO.
The tobacco industry dumps toxic waste into communities and depletes natural resources. There is nothing green about it. Meanwhile, the tobacco industry attempts to rehabilitate its image through programs such as beach cleanups and funding environmental and disaster relief organizations. This is known as greenwashing, and it is nothing more than an industry tactic to build influence and sway policies to help tobacco companies profit. Tobacco is not only poisoning people, it's poisoning our planet.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Funerals are continuing in Uvalde, Texas, for the 19 fourth graders and their two teachers shot dead at Robb Elementary School last week. The state's probe into the police handling of the school shooting is facing a major new obstacle as the police chief of the Uvalde School District, Pete Arredondo, is refusing to cooperate with state investigators. He was the incident commander who ordered officers to wait in the school's hallways for about an hour instead of confronting the gunman, who was eventually shot dead by a Border Patrol agent. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Arredondo was secretly sworn in as a city council member, but no public ceremony was held. Amidst the grief and investigations, demand for legislative action on gun control is mounting. On Tuesday, New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern met with President Biden at the White House, discussing how she responded to the Christchurch mosque mask shooting that killed 51 people in 2019 by banning most semi-automatic weapons. This is Biden.
I've been to more mass shooting aftermaths than I think any president in American history, unfortunately. And it's just so much of it is preventable, and the devastation is amazing.
Bipartisan talks are reportedly now underway on a red flag law that might be able to overcome a Republican-led filibuster in the Senate and allow police with a court order to remove guns from people seen as a threat to themselves or others. Lawmakers are meeting after Texas Senator Ted Cruz, President Trump, and other Republicans addressed the National Rifle Association's annual convention this weekend and oppose calls for new gun control laws.
But many would still tell us that the evil on display in Uvalde or in Buffalo derives from the presence of guns in the hands of ordinary American citizens. It's far easier to slander one's political adversaries and to demand that responsible citizens forfeit their constitutional rights than it is to examine the cultural sickness giving birth to unspeakable acts of evil.
After his speech, blaming other factors besides guns for mass shootings in the United States, Texas Senator Cruz went out for dinner and was confronted by Indivisible Houston board member Ben Hernandez.
And why did you come here to the convention
to
take blood money? Why? When 19 children died, 19 children died. That's on your hands. That is on your hands. That's on your hands.
For more, we're joined by Frank Smythe, longtime investigative journalist who's been covering the NRA for more than a quarter of a century. He's author of the book, The NRA, The Unauthorized History. Frank, welcome back to Democracy Now! Your history is remarkable in reporting over the decades, whether you exposing France, supporting the Rwandans and the genocide by giving military weapons there, or the same in El Salvador, the U.S. support for the murderous regime, and in Guatemala, then taken hostage in Iraq during the Persian Gulf War when your colleague Gad Gross was killed, now taking on the NRA. It's an incredible history that you give. And I'm wondering, as we see NRA member after NRA member, the politicians, that is, not the rank and file, fighting against gun control, you tell a very different history in this book. Why don't you bring out, in a nutshell, the relevant points over the years that have been basically erased of what this organization was about?
The organization, the NRA, and thank you, Amy, claims to be the oldest civil rights organization in the United States. And this is a complete canard. The NRA didn't raise gun rights at all until more than 50 years after it was already in existence, in response to a New York State gun law passed in 1911 that now, ironically, is before the Supreme Court, as well as the Bolshevik Revolution. Those two things led to the first editorial raising the alarm about gun rights in 1922, after the NRA was founded in 1871. The NRA supported gun control, including the 1934 National Firearms Act that outlawed fully automatic weapons in response to the violence of the gangsters like Al Capone during Prohibition. And it also established the first regime to control wholesale transfers of firearms from manufacturers to wholesalers. And that's a system that the NRA doesn't like to talk about, but they still support because it's quite convenient. The NRA then underwent its own what's known in the lore as the Cincinnati Revolt, or an internal revolt, a self-coup, if you will, shifting from an organization that was prioritized the shooting sports and later hunting and always gun safety to then prioritize gun rights or consumer access to firearms, which is what gun rights really means, above everything else. So over the past 45 years, they have pursued an absolutist vision of gun rights, which is based on the idea that there could be no compromise between gun ownership and gun regulations, something that's a complete flip-flop from what the NRA did for over a century before.
And Frank, what was the cause or the basis for that dramatic shift in its policies?
It was the Gun Control Act of 1968, signed by President Johnson. And this was in response to the assassinations of JFK, Martin Luther King, and Bobby Kennedy, those three. It was passed in 1968. It outlawed interstate sale of long rifles like the one that was tied to the assassination of JFK. It also restricted sales of guns to minors and a number of other measures. But there was a group both inside and outside the NRA that saw this as allegedly oppressive government overreach. And the other thing is the gun rights movement likes to claim, the NRA and beyond, that they have roots going back to the Revolutionary War. This is also a canard. The America's gun rights movement started in response to the Gun Control Act of 1968. The first gun rights group in the United States was the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, formed in 1972. Then Gun Owners of America came in 1974. And 3 years later, in 77, the NRA underwent its Cincinnati Revolt. So these are all things that the NRA doesn't want anyone to know. And they've created other myths to advance their agenda.
So in essence, the change came not only in response to Lyndon Johnson's passage of that 68 law, but this was also the period when there were racial disturbances and rebellions in cities across the country. And I recall pictures of hundreds and thousands of people lining up at gun shops, white Americans, to buy guns because they believed at the time that there was a potential racial civil war occurring in the United States. What What role does race play in these changes in policies as well?
It played an undercurrent and had a tremendous role, even though it's rarely talked about. That 1968 law signed by Johnson, too, the Gun Control Act, was supported by the NRA, which that divided the gun community. But there is no doubt that the racial tension of the 1960s played a tremendous role in radicalizing people in the NRA as well as in other groups, leading them to see consumer access to firearms as a priority and something that needs to be prioritized. And also, you can't discount the vigilante movies of the 1970s and the crime that was rising in the early 1970s, especially. And the vigilante concept captured in films like Dirty Harry, the Death Wish series of films, Taxi, and others. All of this played a role in radicalizing a certain element of America's gun movement, which led to these gun rights groups or the Cincinnati Revolt, the turn of the NRA, all in the 1970s.
I wanted to go to 1999. The NRA held its annual convention in Denver just weeks after the massacre at the nearby Columbine High School. NRA President Charlton Heston presided over the meeting. Yes, the famous actor. This is a clip of Charlton Heston speaking the following year.
So, as we set out this year to defeat the divisive forces that would take freedom away, I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
That's Charlton Heston soon after the Columbine massacre. Now, at the same time that you have him as president, you can talk about how that happened. You have Wayne LaPierre rising up in the organization. So we go from the events held after the massacre to a year after to just this last weekend. NRA CEO Wayne LaPierre speaking once again right after a massacre, and this was in Houston, Texas, last weekend.
It's time to restore the American precept that each individual is accountable for his actions. And that's why we, the NRA, will never ever stop fighting for the right of the innocent and the law-abiding to defend themselves against the evil criminal element that plagues our society.
Talk about Wayne LaPierre's rise, Charlton Heston, and what we're seeing today.
Well, Wayne LaPierre he joined the NRA in 1978, so 1 year after the Cincinnati Revolt. And he had worked for a Blue Dog Democrat in the Virginia State House on gun legislation before. And before that, he briefly was a special education public school teacher in both Virginia and New York, which I think is somewhat interesting. So he was a very young man, I think 28, when he joined the NRA. He helped pass the Firearms Owners Protection Act in 1986 during the Reagan administration, which rolled back some of the 1968 law, which really gave him some credibility within the NRA. And then in 1991, after a series of scandals and infighting in the organization that really was threatening to bring it down, they chose LaPierre to become the executive vice president and CEO, which is the title, the combined title now that he uses, in 1991. There was a push then to try and depose him by an individual by the name of Neil Knox, who accused everybody but him of being weak on gun rights as a way of trying to outflank the organization on their core issue. And Charlton Heston was recruited by LaPierre and his allies to come in to defeat that challenge. So when Charlton Heston raised that flintlock rifle and said, from my cold, dead hands, he was playing to the public, and he was also playing internally to the NRA because he needed to show his gun rights credentials in order to keep to support LaPierre and keep him in power. Now, what's also interesting after Columbine is LaPierre, and nobody talks about this, but CNN unearthed it recently, testified and talked about how the NRA has no problem with full background checks, that he has no problem with what we now call universal background checks. This is an amazing thing, because now they claim, and they for 20 years they've claimed since then, that background checks pose an existential threat to liberty and could lead to genocide, because background checks wouldn't work now, as they explain it, without gun registration. And gun registration, we all know, is the slippery slope to disarmament followed by tyranny and genocide. This is ridiculous, but after Columbine, LaPierre said the complete opposite. So this flip-flop is something he hasn't been held accountable for, though it would be very easy. But I think the gun reform people and the Democrats have been reluctant to challenge the NRA, and I think that is a strategic failure on their part.
And Frank, I wanted to ask you, those who want to defend gun rights, supposedly within the NRA, constantly point to these mass shootings as being results of individual evil, reflective of a moral decay in society, but they never talk about comparing what happens here in the United States to other countries in the world. This extraordinary, unique situation of the United States with so many guns and so much gun violence. Could you put it in perspective for people who are not aware what the situation is in other countries around the world?
Yeah, thank you, Juan. Great question. Here it is. The United States has 25 times more gun violence than other advanced nations on average. 25 times. So what's the difference between us and those other advanced nations? Every one of those nations has a national system to regulate retail firearm sales, consumer firearm sales. The United States is the only advanced nation or nation anywhere in the world that leaves retail regulation consumer firearm sales up to our regional governments or individual states. Nobody else does that. So what that means is that in Chicago, up to 60% of the weapons seized in crimes came from out of state, because it's the states with weak gun laws that supply the guns that are used in crimes to a large degree, in the states with stronger gun laws, not to mention guns that are trafficked to Mexico, Central America, and throughout the Caribbean. The NRA likes to talk about what cultural sickness, as Ted Cruz put it. There's a movement now in the gun reform community or the gun safety community to talk about it as a gun safety issue and talk about reframe it all as a safety issue. I think that's not strong enough. I think we should be reframing this issue in the United States. I'm an independent, but I support gun control, and I'm also a gun owner, by the way, and I support gun control. But we need to frame this as, why are we the only nation that does not regulate retail firearm sales? And why is it that 50 years ago this was talked about by President Johnson? Why is it today that neither Republicans nor the Democrats are afraid to talk about this issue, whether the Republicans are using it to derail every measure that the Democrats bring forward? It's almost like a chess game, and the Democrats have been completely outmaneuvered by the Republicans and the gun lobby, meaning the NRA and the gun industry, and they really don't know what to do. The Democrats are completely divided and unclear about what they want now, and that is a problem, you know, about what needs to happen going forward. And that's because the Democrats have encouraged the gun reform people to take the approach, the way you pass legislation is you reach across the aisle and find common ground. The whole gun lobby's whole point is no compromise, no common ground. So when they raise background checks, Josh Hawley a year ago talked about gun registration being a threat to liberty. And he didn't mention it, but this is a canard based on a fabulous distortion of the Holocaust, claiming prior gun registration lists enabled it. Right? This is completely untrue. But this is the kind of propaganda the gun lobbies put out that nobody's challenged yet in the United States. But if you go talk to anybody in the gun rights community, if you go to any NRA meeting, or if you go to gun clubs and you ask people, hey, explain to me the slippery slope, They'll read it like it's gospel truth, and this is part of the problem.
Frank, we have to wrap up now, but I wanted to ask you about the fact that isn't the NRA at its lowest ebb, internecine fighting, corruption probes? The interaction of the NRA, and you describe this so well in your book, with the gun industry and how much power that has, and its nexus, how it all got exposed at Sandy Hook.
Yeah, the NRA is imploding in my view, and I think they will not survive a New York Attorney General civil lawsuit against them for massive embezzlement, where the charges originated with the whistleblower Oliver North. People forget that, but it's Oliver North, Iran-Contra Oliver North, who first accused LaPierre of embezzling funds, and he hasn't backed down. He's just gone quiet about that. So they're in trouble. But the ideology that they have cooked up at the same time that they are waning is stronger than ever. And this is what is the legacy of the NRA and the gun lobby. And this is what I think people that want to pursue gun reform do not understand. It's not the NRA's money, not so much anymore. It's still important, but it's the ideology. It's the fact that they've convinced tens of millions of Americans that any gun control poses an existential threat to their freedom. This is ridiculous and kind of remarkable that they've convinced people of this, because it's all based on false history and convoluted theories that are as crazy as anything you'd find on QAnon and predate QAnon. But the NRA's been up to this now for decades, and it's having they've managed to convince a great many people. And this is something that the Democrats and the gun reformers haven't even begun to address.
Frank Smyth, I want to thank you for being with us. Longtime investigative journalist, author of The NRA, The Unauthorized History. Next up, it was March 29, 2018, when a U.S. drone strike hit a car with five men, all of them cousins. Four were killed. We'll hear from the survivor. Stay with us.
There's a light at the end of the darkness, and it shines for all the world to see. It will shine.
Larry Gatlin, the Texas country music star. This is Light at the End of the Darkness. He's also known for his song Houston. He's one of four musicians who refused to play at the NRA convention and has called for gun control. He said he didn't even think the NRA convention should have taken place. He's an NRA member himself, if only if they met to have a moment of silence for the people who were killed, the children and teachers in Uvalde. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. It was March 29th, 2018. When a U.S. drone strike in Yemen hit the car of Adel al-Manthari and his four cousins. They were driving the car. They went to serve as witnesses for a land deal. A short video recording of the aftermath shows the car they were riding and engulfed in flames. Adel al-Manthari was the only survivor. He suffered severe burns. In a minute, we'll speak with his supporters who say the Pentagon should pay for the surgery he needs to keep his legs. But so far, the Pentagon's refused to acknowledge Adel al-Manthari and his cousins were civilians and that the drone strike was a mistake. In a statement recorded for Democracy Now!, Manthari speaks from his hospital bed describing his struggle.
It affected me greatly. My children are without their schools. My life is scattered. My children stay with me and cannot go out because of my disability. 4 years and I haven't moved. I cannot do anything without my children, and I do not move except with my children's help. I can only go to the bathroom with my children. I can only wash with my children. And I can only walk with my children. I deprive them of their youth, and they are just school children. I deprive them of education. I deprive them of freedom. I deprived them of going out and mixing with people because they sat with me at home for 24 hours a day. I have a son who finished high school and has hopes that he will finish his university education, but he could not. And I have another son who finished the ninth grade when the strike happened and did not continue his education because he was attending to me. I have two daughters who were deprived of school. My whole family is shattered, and they tell us that they are fighting terrorism. What kind of terrorism? What is this terrorism they are fighting? Where is it? They should know who they are and who they are bombing, not like this.
That's Adel El-Montari speaking from his hospital bed. His supporters have asked the Pentagon to, quote, urgently reopen the assessment into civilian casualties in this strike, and specifically his status as a civilian injured, so he can be eligible for the funds to get life-saving treatment. Investigations by the Yemen-based human rights group Mawtana and the Associated Press, as well as the journalism outlet Air Wars and Yemeni tribal leaders, have all concluded there's no evidence Al-Montari's family was linked to Al-Qaeda. For more, we're joined by two guests. Kathy Kelly, longtime peace activist, author, who is a founding member of Voices in the Wilderness, as well as co-coordinator of Ban Killer Drones campaign, raising funds for Adel El-Montari's medical care to help him recover from the U.S. drone strike. She's also a member of the World Beyond War. Also with us is Aisha Dennis, project manager on extrajudicial executions for Reprieve, which is supporting this effort and has built close relationships with communities affected by U.S. drone strikes over the past decade. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Aisha, let's begin with you. Tell us more about Adel's situation, how you know about this drone strike, and what the Pentagon is denying or saying.
So Adel first came to our attention shortly after the strike back in 2018, and we've followed his case since then. He has, as you said and as you've heard, suffered very severe injuries, not just burns, but also fracture to his hip, severe injuries to his hand and to his legs. He has been put in a situation by the DOD's lack of response on this issue where he is effectively fighting for his quality of life and his dignity and to survive. We filed a complaint with the DOD in response to his worsening condition about a month ago, but it's important to note that this isn't the first time that the DOD has been alerted to this strike and the plight of the Mandari family. So back in 2018, we and the Daily Beast engaged the DOD and they refused to respond. They said they were going to conduct a civilian casualty assessment, but they didn't. Not to our knowledge anyway. They certainly didn't engage with the community that was affected. They didn't engage with the family themselves. Then Mawtana, as you mentioned, and also Columbia Law School brought the strike to their attention amongst a set of other strikes that resulted in civilian casualties. Again, they barely responded. After months, they came back saying that they rejected claims that there were civilian casualties, but they didn't explain why. The case was then brought to their attention again by Senators Warren and Senator Murphy. And again, the DOD failed to take this seriously. Then Adel's condition severely deteriorated, and we knew that we had to act. We've helped to work with Ban Killer Drones and partners in Egypt to secure his care. But we understand from doctors there that he still needs three further operations.
I'd like to bring Kathy Kelly into the discussion. You're the co-coordinator of Ban Killer Drones. We've been hearing a lot in the war in Ukraine now, a lot of praise for the effectiveness of drone strikes. But could you give us a bigger picture of what the record is of these drone strikes, especially in the Middle East and in the Horn of Africa and Yemen, where they've been used so much over the recent decades?
Well, thank you, Juan. I think that Adel's testimony helps us understand the permanent trauma and harm caused by drone attacks to thousands and thousands of survivors and their family members, people who are maimed, people who are traumatized, And, you know, there's a tremendous secrecy around the use of United States weaponized drones. But now we are seeing the proliferation of drone warfare, and it does make it easier on the part of those using weaponized drones to continue to prolong, to exacerbate warfare. And, you know, the proxy nature of it, that, you know, it would seem that there's no harm done to the people operating the drones, but that's not true either, because the moral injury, the personal conscientious harm done to the operators of the drones is something we must consider. Daniel Hale, when he was standing before a judge who sentenced him to 4 years in prison because of his disclosure about the consequences of drone warfare in Afghanistan alone, he said that 90% of the time the people that were killed weren't even the ones that were supposedly to be targeted. And he said, I could no longer take what was not mine to take, innocent lives. And so I think Adil's testimony discloses a story that has been replicated again and again and again. He speaks of the family of Zemarai Ahmadi, 10 people, 3 of them toddlers, 7 of them children. In no way could they have been estimated to be terrorists. And the Department of Defense exonerated itself, said that no wrong was done.
I wanted to go to the comments of the Pentagon. In May, the New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize for their, quote, courageous and relentless reporting that exposed the vast civilian toll of U.S.-led airstrikes, challenging official accounts of American military engagements in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby responded to the Pulitzer.
We knew that we had made mistakes. We're trying to learn from those mistakes. We knew that we weren't always as transparent about those mistakes as we should be. But their reporting reinforced those concerns and in some cases gave us cause for additional concerns. And it made us ask ourselves some new and difficult questions of our own, even as it forced us to answer their difficult questions.
So that's the Pentagon press spokesperson, John Kirby. Aisha Dennis, if you can respond to this and also how it would specifically apply to Adil Mazhari.
I think the first point to make is that when he says that these are mistakes, it seeks to trivialize what we're talking about, which is the killing and maiming of civilians. A mistake is when you leave your car keys at home or you send an email to the wrong person. We're talking about systemic failures, repeated strikes against civilians, and also the repeated failure and refusal to engage with the evidence. So it's great that the DOD are learning or attempting to learn from past mistakes, and we very much welcome that sentiment. But we also know that Lloyd Austin has said that they will refuse to litigate the past. And what he means by that is that they will refuse to investigate prior strikes. But the problem is, how can the DOD hope to learn from previous strikes when they won't grapple with the evidence and what has really happened? They're not talking to communities, they're not talking to experts. And in Adil's case, we are very, very happy to engage with them directly, to put them in contact with his doctors, with witnesses on the ground, and with the Yemeni authorities that can testify to the fact that he was a senior civil servant.
I want to end with the words of Adil Al-Mazhari himself, speaking from his hospital bed in Egypt.
All U.S. administrations are the same. They all lack transparency and do not value human life. Biden's administration is the same as Trump's. They all have the same politics and do not respect any citizen in any country. They have drones without pilots that carelessly drop their bombs without knowing if the target is a terrorist group or civilians. What I know as someone who lives in the area that was bombed is that most people are innocent and have no links to terrorism.
That is Adil talking from his hospital bed. Kathy Kelly, final comment on the Pentagon not acknowledging this, not giving money, though money is allocated for civilian deaths, so-called collateral damage. So how are you raising money for Adil?
Well, if you go to the Ban Killer Drones site, there is a section at which people can get to the GoFundMe campaign that we have. And there is still more money needed to meet the goal for that campaign. It's a scandal that the Pentagon can completely dodge responsibility, but people's generosity can help Adil now.
How much money have you raised?
$18,642.
How much does he need?
There's an estimated 25,000. There are still more surgeries. And, of course, he's going to face a lifetime of striving for physical therapy and resolving trauma.
Kathy Kelly, longtime peace activist, co-coordinator of Ban Killer Drones campaign, fundraising for Adil Al-Mantari's medical care. And Aisha Dennis, thank you so much for being with us, project manager on extrajudicial executions for Reprieve. Next up, civil rights groups are challenging a series of racist Supreme Court rulings that have been used for over a century to legally justify discrimination against people in Puerto Rico and other U.S. territories. Stay with us.
Del Caribe, el roble y el Guayacán, así se vive en el ojo del huracán, uva de playa, montaña, mujeres bellas, esta es la isla donde nacen las estrellas.
Una lluvia de adoquines para emprender el camino, cruzamos en esta ruta que por siglos construimos, una avalancha de gente que despierta a los vecinos para abrir la nueva ruta que le dé para el destino, como si un golpe de agua se disfrazara de fuego, como un río de esperanza para abonar dicho suelo. De motoras unidas como un cometa, inundando la ciudad porque el pueblo se respeta. Una ristra de macanas y de gases para el llanto, amenizando la fiesta que estábamos preparando. Un carnaval de adoquines.
Oldest Colonia by 7-9, Emil Martinez, Luis Diaz, and SJ. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We continue to look now at a new campaign by civil rights groups urging the federal government to overturn a series of U.S. Supreme Court rulings that have for over a century been used as the legal justification to racially discriminate against people living in Puerto Rico and other U.S. territories. The rulings are known as the Insular Cases, which opponents have long denounced as some of the most racist U.S. Supreme Court rulings, firmly rooted in white supremacy to protect U.S. colonialism. The Insular Cases have allowed the U.S. federal government to deny Puerto Ricans living on the island and voting rights, access to public social programs like Medicaid and food stamps, and other equal protections as those residing on the mainland U.S. The renewed efforts to overturn the Insular Cases come about a month after the Supreme Court sided with the Biden administration to continue denying SSI, that Supplemental Security Income benefits to seniors and people with disabilities living in Puerto Rico. The lone dissenter was Justice Sonia Sotomayor, whose parents were born on the island. She referred to the 8-1 ruling as irrational and antithetical. But what came as a surprise in this case was a 10-page concurring opinion written by the conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch, calling on completely overthrowing the Insular Cases. In part, Gorsuch wrote, quote, "A century ago in the Insular Cases, this court held that the federal government could rule Puerto Rico and other territories largely without regard to the Constitution. It's past time to acknowledge the gravity of this error and admit what we know to be true. The Insular Cases have no foundation in the Constitution and rest instead on racial stereotypes. They deserve no place in our law," the ultra-conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote. Well, for more, we're joined in New York City by Leah Fiomata, senior counselor for Latino Justice, Pearl Duff, where her work focuses on economic justice and issues related to Puerto Rico. Latino Justice, alongside the American Civil Liberties Union and other civil rights groups, have joined forces in this renewed effort to overrule the Insular Cases. Also with us is Juan Gonzalez, the co-host of Democracy Now!, Juan, when you first responded to the Supreme Court decision and pointed out what Neil Gorsuch had said, in addition to Sonia Sotomayor, this was one of the most popular commentaries on our website. And so we want to ask Leah, for starters, what is this campaign all about? How are you organizing and why are you doing it?
Good morning. It's such a pleasure to be here. This campaign is pretty much coordinated between Latino Justice, Hispanic Federation, the ACLU, and Equally American, as well as other allies, but these are the main organizations. And we have embarked on a strong campaign, which started before the Valle Madero decision was even issued, against the insular cases through public education, presentations, media contacts like this one as well. And also we are embarked on a campaign to continue pressuring the Biden administration to denounce the insular cases and for federal courts to stop relying on them as well. Our main concern, obviously, at this moment is to have the Supreme Court finally overrule the insular cases in a case that has been filed for cert for consideration of the Supreme Court, which is Fitisemanu versus the United States. But also we want to pressure Congress to pass legislation to also support federal benefits programs to residents of the territories equally.
And Leah, I wanted to ask you about the Fitisemanu versus United States case. This is a case of U.S. citizens from American Samoa. Can you talk about that case and how it's similar to the issues raised in Puerto Rico and other U.S. territories?
Well, first of all, the American Samoans are not American citizens, and that is at the crux of this case. They are considered United States nationals. So the case is to request or to demand U.S. citizenship, but also directly for the Supreme Court to overrule the insular cases. The organization that I represent, Latino Justice, and others have joined in an amicus brief, a friend of the court briefed, asking the Supreme Court to take on the case, particularly because it is a frontal attack on the insular cases. And that is because the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals relied on the insular cases, even though they denounced them also and criticized them, but they said that the insular cases gives Congress the authority to make decisions about the territories, and therefore, relying on the insular cases, the 10th Circuit reversed the District Court of Utah that had agreed with the plaintiffs that American Samoans should enjoy all citizenship rights as other territories of the United States.
One of the things that has struck me over the years on the court decisions regarding Puerto Rico is the absence of the so-called liberal justices on the Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when she was on there, Stephen Breyer, Justice Kagan, have not really dared to tackle the precedent set by the insular cases in any frontal way. I'm wondering your thoughts on that and how this might conceivably change, especially now that an extreme conservative justice like Gorsuch has taken such a strong stand.
Absolutely. You know, in Valle Madero, civil rights activists, we were not necessarily expecting for Valle Madero to prevail. We were hoping that that would happen, but due to the conservative court, we were not really very much expecting that outcome, but we were terribly disappointed that the other liberal justices did not join the dissent, the strong and fantastic dissent of Sonia Sotomayor. So we are also grappling with that, and hopefully in this next case that is pending, which is Fitisemanu, hopefully we might have a change, because as you know, in the Valle Madero decision, like you mentioned, both Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Gorsuch denounced the insular cases. And Justice Gorsuch had already hinted at this. Well, not really hinted. He had pretty much in oral arguments in November asked the federal government, why don't we just overrule the insular cases? And the federal government, the Solicitor General, kind of said, yeah, these are not great cases, but this is not the crux of this matter right now before you. So they kind of skirted the issue. But Gorsuch had already signaled his opposition. And then, of course, in his concurrence in Valle Madero, which is very long and extensive and detailed, he provides even the historical context of the court, and he denounces them very, very strenuously. So we're hoping that both those of those justices, and then hoping that the liberals as well. Now, obviously, we're going to have a new liberal justice on the court at the time if this case is taken up by the court. So our fingers are crossed that this will be, hopefully, this will be the case that will finally have these cases overruled.
Juan, you know, when you, you know, shared this commentary on the insular cases, I was wondering if you could once again talk about why they're called insular cases, this whole century history, and why it is Justice Gorsuch, how it fits into the ultra-conservative philosophy of him to talk about these racist laws.
Well, I think the key thing to understand is that in the aftermath of the Spanish-American War, when the United States acquired the remaining territories of the Spanish Empire, including the Philippines, temporarily Cuba as well, and Puerto Rico, and that there was a debate as to, well, what's the relationship between these non-contiguous territories of the United States, these new places where the American flag was planted, and the rest of the country. And so between in the early 1900s, in a series of decisions, a lot of them having to deal basically with tariffs and do tariffs apply, you know, it was a lot of commercial issues, but there were also individual issues as to what rights of the Constitution apply in Puerto Rico. Several cases, Balzac versus Puerto Rico, Downs versus Bidwell, and a bunch of other cases, the court had to grapple with this and essentially said that, yes, the Constitution only applies in these territories at the to the level which Congress decides it can apply, and that Congress has complete power to decide how to run these territories. And so basically, it established the legal basis for the holding of a colonial empire. And so that is really has never really been challenged in 100 years in any significant way, except in the last few years with the crises in Puerto Rico, especially, and there have been several cases, and now, of course, this American Samoa case. So now, for the first time, really, people are grappling with what it means, because in the meantime, there's been, and I'm sure Leah can talk much more extensively about this, how the insular cases have been used to provide second-class benefits to the people of Puerto Rico, especially, because in some cases, even the Virgin Islands have been exempted by Congress from some of the more onerous second-class services that the government provides to the territories. Leah, if you could talk about some of the concrete ways that this affects the people of Puerto Rico.
Absolutely. I would also like to say that the insular cases established a doctrine that has no constitutional basis, which is the territorial incorporation doctrine. And the five inhabited colonies of the United States are considered unincorporated territories, and only quote unquote fundamental rights apply to them. And those are decided by Congress arbitrarily. So in terms of Puerto Rico specifically, we know that the Valle Madero decision denies SSI benefits to the neediest Americans, the poor, disabled, blind, and elderly American citizens that reside in Puerto Rico. And there are other federal benefits as well that were not considered in that case. But there were other cases, for example, Peña Martinez, the Department of Health and Human Services, that case involved SSI as well as SNAP and Medicare, other benefits in which Puerto Ricans on the residents of the island are treated unequally to the other states of the United States. And unfortunately, that case, which was being appealed at the First Circuit, I guess pretty much is moot at this point, as well as other cases in addition to that one. So yes, absolutely. The benefits and the decisions that have been applied to the different territories are very arbitrary. I want to point out that the Northern Mariana Islands, they do have SSI, and that was part of the deed of cession that was decided.
Leo,
with
we
United
just have
States.
We just have 10 seconds. What can Biden do specifically now? 10 seconds.
President Biden needs to denounce the insular cases, needs to instruct federal, well, he cannot instruct them, but needs to exhort federal courts to stop utilizing and relying on that, and needs to
Leah Theomata, we have to leave it there. Senior Counsel for Latino Justice, Pearl Def. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. We're still hearing responses to the jogger who was on our show who wanted a word to say when he's coming up behind somebody so that he doesn't startle them. And I think the most popular suggestion turned out to be just to say, on your left or on your right. But we also heard from Victoria Wolf in Sacramento, California, who said that conversation brought up another question that's been bugging her. Say you're driving a car and you make a mistake, and you know it's your mistake. You pulled out in front of somebody when you shouldn't have. How do you signal to them, oops, my bad?
Oh, I know what I do. I mouth the word sorry in exaggerated facial expressions. I get as close to the windshield as I can so they can really see my face. And I don't know if it works, but it makes me feel better.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I struggle with this myself because I feel like if I stuck my face close to the window and said, sorry, you know, they might think I'm saying something nasty to them. And, you know, I mean, I know that I've done these things where I've been waving my arms like, oops, you know, it's my bad. I know, you know, I'm pointing to myself, but I'm sure it just looks like somebody who's furious. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, how do we say, oops, my mistake? And all I could think of, Grant, was that I looked up the sign in American Sign Language for sorry, the word sorry, and you form a fist in your hand and you rotate it on your chest using a couple of clockwise motions. I don't know that that would work. I don't know that the people are going to see that, but I hope that somebody has a good idea for us because I think this would be one small step for civility in our culture.
Yeah, because we have some of these other hand signals that are clear, like the little how you doing hand flap, whether your hand's on the steering wheel where you only lift up the fingers.
The hand flap.
And we've got the little you go ahead hand motion, you know, and it's not clear whose turn it is or there's a pedestrian waiting to cross. So some of the stuff is very clear, but you're right. This is a gap. This is not a lexical gap. This is a gesture gap.
I would love to know what people suggest for us.
Well, the toll-free line is open in Canada and the United States, 877-929-9600. 673, answer this question if you would, or tell us your language thoughts, stories, and ideas. You can also tell us an email, words@waywardradio.org, or let's have a fun chat on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, my name is Heidi. I live in Vermont. And the question I have is regarding the term call out that sounds very strange to me because I would use the term call in. I would say I'm going to call in sick. My daughters, who are in their 20s and they work at a cafe, I would overhear them talking and they'd say, oh, so-and-so called out today. And that means that the person was sick and they called in to work to say that they were sick and weren't able to come in. But they say called out and everybody knows it means that you're sick and not coming to work. And that just sounds very foreign to me because you're calling into work. So I'm wondering whether that's a generational thing or if it's a regional thing. I grew up in the Midwest, although when I was in the workforce, I'm self-employed now, so I never get to call in sick. But when I was in the workforce, I worked in Michigan and I also worked in Massachusetts, and I have never heard the term call out used until just in the past few years, hearing it from my daughters.
Okay.
Oh, so wonderful to get the field report. You've laid it out so nicely for us with all the details and the descriptions and everything. We have talked about this before, and I bring that up just to say that lots